Hey guys, welcome to the Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast. Just want to talk to you a little bit before we jump into this next episode. You heard me say it a million times. Please give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this free. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Make an amazing product. Even if you're not a rifle hunter, pick up one of their glassing pads. You will thank me for it later. And I'm happy to announce our partnership with Primos and Bushnell. I've been using the Primos Hyperdome single reed. It's a great cow call. And I used a Hyperdome mini to make calf sounds. And if you listen to my podcast with Joel Turner, you'll know how important it is to have that in your bag of tricks to be able to make calf sounds. Bushnell makes awesome trail cameras. And if you go back and you look at my blog back in 2013 and in 2015, I did independent tests on trail cameras and Bushnell came up out on top both times. This season, behind the scenes, I did another trail camera test on a few different brands and Bushnell rose to the top again in bang for the buck, quality, and overall usability. So we decided to partner up with them. And the great thing about that is I'm going to pass along a discount to you guys. You can save 15% if you go to their website and use promo code STL02. That's STL02. Save 15% on anything. Doesn't have to be the things that I use. We use their ground blinds, a couple of their elk calls, and we use the trophy cam. It's an excellent product. Go check them out. I also want to talk to you a little bit about, I know it seems early in the season, but if you don't already know, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I am an outfitter here in Arizona and I do run hunts in South Dakota. My busiest time of year is archery deer season here in Arizona. We take out just a handful of, I'm busy because I only take out a select few amount of clients. So if it's something you want to get in on, I have a couple slots left. And I'm telling you this now, early in the season, because people always scramble after they realize that they didn't get enough hunting in for the year or they didn't draw the tags that they want to get in on that hunt. Also, javelina season. The draw is going to be coming up in the next couple of months. I know it seems far away, but it's really not. October is not that far away. And if you want to get in on an excellent hunt, or if you've never been out west or to Arizona and you want to try something new during a time that there's nothing going on, what are you going to do in February? Twiddle your thumbs? Come out. We have amazing hunts. You could do it with a bow. You could do it with a rifle. You could do it with the muzzleloader. Just all around inexpensive, good time, good way to spend the last few months of winter and come out and experience nice weather on a super fun hunt. Get in contact with me. We fill up quick. I take anywhere between 12 to 16 hunters a year on that hunt and the camps fill up really quick. So give us a call. Check out daysinthewild.com. Send me a message. Any way you want to get in contact with me, social media, we'd like to put together a hunt for you. So without further ado, let's jump into this next episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we're going to talk to Travis Adams, and Travis is a guide in Utah, and we're going to pick his brain a little bit and listen to some of his stories and about mule deer hunting. We might catch one or two about elk hunting as well. So, what's going on, Travis? How are you?
Man, I'm doing good, and I appreciate the invite. Good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Love to have you on.
Always enjoy talking about hunting.
Don't we all? My wife gets pissed at me all the time. She sees me walking away with the phone, and she knows if I'm talking about hunting, she gets pissed. She's out here. Because I'm always doing it. So why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself and what you do?
Well, I own an outfitting company called Bucks and Bulls Guides and Outfitters. We're based in Utah, and a lot of our hunting takes place in Utah. We also operate in New Mexico real heavily.
Oh, nice.
Our forte is giant mule deer, giant elk, and down in New Mexico, we're known for a lot of Boone and Crockett antelope. So we pride ourselves on trophy hunting. Our little niche in the industry would be that we operate a lot of private ground. So we're definitely fortunate to have some really good hunting on private ground. I have played around in the public hunting, guiding, outfitting, and boy, that is a challenge. So I'll come right off and say that I'm definitely fortunate and blessed to hunt some of the greatest private ground there is.
Yeah. You know, it's a different animal altogether, you know, both figuratively and literally in a lot of ways. Just the logistics of hunting on public ground, getting guys' tags and keeping track of certain animals and so on and so forth, especially if you're running a trophy business, you know, a trophy outfitting business where guys are coming for a specific caliber of deer or whatever. It definitely makes for harder hunting, just not necessarily harder hunting, because the hunting sometimes could be just as hard on private, but
yeah,
it's definitely more to it. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. Well, my hat's off to the outfitters that have made their living on private ground, or excuse me, public ground. I always sit back and pinch myself to do this job. And then I look at guys that are real successful on public ground, and they have definitely a skill set and a tolerance for other things that I don't necessarily think I could do. You know, we're a lot more controlled. Obviously, you're not going to have anybody boogering up your hunt most times. So, yeah, it's a different animal. But you're right. When you start getting into older age class animals in the mule deer and elk world, that's a whole different species in and of itself. I mean, the species is the same. But you start talking 8-9-year-old mule deer that have outsmarted. They're just a different animal. They have a sixth sense about them that I've learned over the years that is so admirable. And to get one of those types of bucks, or bulls for that matter, to the point where you get to harvest it with a client, which is mostly what I do anymore, is just I scratch my itch, so to speak, taking folks out that don't normally get to do this stuff and show them the hunt of a lifetime and maybe possibly harvest the animal of a lifetime. That really gets me going.
Nice.
But yeah, them older age class animals, they're just a whole different ball game.
Awesome. So if you could share with us like a story that you kind of learned something about hunting mule deer, or maybe change the way you hunt them now because of that hunt.
I can put my finger on a mule deer hunt that definitely changed the way I did a lot of things. And he was a particular buck. Now you got to remember, John, when you have these aha moments and you've been doing it almost 25 years, a lot of those are 20 years ago that you learned these moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This was in the mid to late 90s, right? Before trail cams and really long range hunting wasn't the big thing. But mule deer still to this day act the same as those bucks back in the 90s. So, sure. And you know that it's popular to have groups of guides hunting for one client in the caliber of clients that I tend to attract. This was back in the mono a mono, you know, one guide, no radio, one client and one buck. And this one particular buck, and I was in my 20s, and he was one of those lifetime bucks that, you know, you dream about. And we found him early in July, like this time of year. We're on this podcast mid-July, and this is about exactly the same time of year I found this buck. And number one, right off the bat, if you want to have a successful early season archery, say mule deer hunt, you learn to scout. Scouting is key. And back then, it wasn't that. Nowadays, it's a big deal. People go scout quite a bit. They spend a lot of time looking. Back then, it wasn't quite as popular as it is now. So I scouted this buck up. I knew he was special. I knew I had a client coming in first part of September. And he was, if you can imagine, 32 to 33 inches outside spread. He had a split eye guard on one side. He had some junk going on. He was real smart. He would only show up right before dark. Very rarely saw him in the morning. And the terrain was a lot of sagebrush bowls. So if you can imagine rolling hills with a lot of sagebrush and then these big strips of quake and aspen trees. And they would be maybe 1 to 2 miles wide of just a patch of aspens and then fairly open country all around that. And he was living in that patch of aspens, essentially. I didn't know it at the time, but I later learned that he was living in that patch of aspens, and he would come out of those aspens, and you really just needed to flip a coin. When I first started hunting him, I would be trying to second guess him on which side of that aspen or which way he was going to come out. Because essentially that ridge that the aspens was on run north and south. So if you can imagine that ridge running north and south with the aspens on it, and then open on the east and west. So you would get on the western side to keep an eye on him and hope he comes out and try and ambush him with a hunter, and he wouldn't show up. And then you'd jump over on the west side or east side, and you'd bounce back and forth. You'd try the south side. So this buck also we had a history with. We had a hunter miss him the year before, and so we kind of knew this buck was smart. But what I learned, the aha moment that hit me when I was younger with this particular buck, and I remember mentors and people on that used to watch, you know, VHS tapes of guys hunting, some of our Jim Zumbos and things like that. They would say, put the sun at your back, the sun at your back and the wind in your face. If you remember that, John.
Yep, absolutely.
And what I learned was the opposite of the sun. So what I can explain is, the more you're looking into that sun, and I'm saying right when sun's breaking that ridgeline in the morning, or sun is just barely setting down in the evening, that is the worst viewing conditions, right? I mean, mm-hmm. That sun is blazing through your scope or blazing through your binoculars, and it is so uncomfortable. Right. But I'm here to tell you that if you're not looking into the sun, if you're not looking in the shadows of ridges and canopies, etc., the terrain, if you're not looking in the shadows, then you're making a mistake.
Yep.
You're going to see game in the sunshine. But the caliber of animals that we all dream about, I've always kind of jokingly said they are like vampires. They don't like the sun to touch them. Even their antler tips, you've seen it before where they'll be feeding and the sun hits their antler tips and just graces the top of their back. And boy, they're in the trees right then.
Oh, yeah, they're running.
Yeah. So that particular buck, now I know what was going on. You have that aha moment. You put two and two together. So what he was doing was he was coming out on that ridge in the evenings in that shadow. And I know it sounds simple now, but back then it was really something that clicked with me. When I finally figured that out, now he was starting to get in trouble. And we come in there one night. We set up at about, this was a rifle hunter, 350 yards. And that buck stood inside those quaking aspens. All he could see was his white face and his white legs amongst them quaking aspens. And he was back in there about 20 to 30 yards. And he would just stand there like a statue. And he was just waiting for the light to get less and less and dimmer and dimmer before he actually started to walk out. And he was so cautious. And it wasn't like he knew we were there. He was just an overly cautious buck, you know, 24/7. And I tell you this, I like these kind of stories the most. I mean, we all like luck. We like to come around the corner and have the buck of a lifetime or bull of a lifetime standing there and you just pound him. And it's just a great moment. But when I think back to some of my most fulfilling times, it's going to be one of these sagas where you live with the deer. You get up at 2 in the morning. You go down at 11 at night. You're studying topographical maps. Back then, there was no Onyx. So we would print out the 7.5 minute angle maps and we'd study those. And that was an aha moment for me, John, on the, if you're not glassing into that very painful sun in the evenings and mornings, you're probably doing yourself a disservice. Switch your tactics up and look into them shadows of the ridges, the sagebrush, what have you, whatever terrain you're in. And I believe wholeheartedly that you will see more game, especially older age class animals.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. Like, especially on those early hunts, and even more so in the Southwest, like here in Arizona and Southern Utah and whatnot. It's just those deer don't want to be out in the damn heat. You know, they don't want to be in that blazing sun. I mean, we see that all the time here with coos deer. I mean, if you're not burning your eyes out with the sun, you're not looking in the right spot. That's kind of what, honestly, that's why I love hunting the rut, because it's not the opposite, but it's almost the opposite. They come out, you know, sunny. They come out in the sun to get away from, you know, the cold and whatnot. But
they do.
Those late season hunts.
But it's a great feeling when you finally figure something out, and that challenge that's just been driving you crazy, you finally figure it out and it all comes together. When you get into the rut, you know, all bets are off. But what you learn is, I almost think it's not like they don't want to be in the blazing sun. It's almost like they have a mentality that they don't want to be exposed. It feels like maybe they're a beacon, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've almost thought that a lot of times, that they feel exposed if the sun's on them. I know that's crazy.
You know, I thought that too for a long time, and there probably is something with that. Yeah. But then I thought about all the cloudy days, and
that's true.
You know, they still come out on like an open face or whatever. You know, yeah. I don't know. It's so tough to say. You'd have to be psychic or be able to talk to deer.
Yeah.
But,
the other thing,
I'm sure it's got a little bit of both. Has a little bit of both.
The other thing that I learned early on that hunt, and maybe a few others, was in the mule deer world. You know, I don't hunt the strip, and down there where you're at, I'm hunting some, you know, 10,000 foot mountains. And those mule deer have a very small home range, and I'm talking like within a mile. This would be another buck that I can tell you about. That buck ended up going down, and he was a 200 inch frame, 32 inch wide, with about 10 inches of trash. Nice. One of those bigger, nice dream bucks early on in my career. And then later on, this would kind of be a time where I would call it somewhere where you would never think a deer would live, a big deer. You know, this buck was pushing 220. He was actually next to a public road. And we were, here you are, you and your client, you're headed up to the backcountry to the quote unquote honey hole.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking for a giant deer. And it's taking you an hour and a half drive to get up there and a 45 minute hike. And you're doing this every day. And you're doing it at 3 a.m. going in and 10 o'clock at night coming out. And we would come past this one spot, and boom, there is a giant mule deer standing in the headlights on a two-track dirt road that is actually a public road that we had to use to access our ranch. Well, our ranch wasn't too far away. It was about 3/4 of a mile from that public road. And after seeing that buck, kind of got me thinking that obviously we're going to try and see where he's living. But I give it one more day in the high country. I just didn't want to give up there where I thought there was going to be a buck that this guy would be satisfied with. So we give it one more day. We're on our way back. Lo and behold, when you go a little bit slower, you're coming back in at night, and there's the freaking deer standing 100 yards off the road. Same deer. You turn the truck so you get your headlights on him. I'm like, wow, okay, now we got a pattern. So the next day, I sit up on the high on a big high point looking down on that road, and I can still see our ranch. I cannot harvest this buck if he's on public, but I can if he's going on to the ranch. And I look for him. Nothing happens. Never see him again. that season goes away. And that buck haunts me all off season. So the next year, same thing, replay, clients in camp. That buck's still on my mind. I don't know that anybody ever took him. You know, you keep an eye on social media. You keep an eye on everywhere you can to see if that buck got killed by a public hunter. Never saw anything. So I assumed he was still alive. He was very, very nocturnal. The next year, I go sit on that point. And I catch what I think is a glimpse of that buck one morning just going into the trees. I could just see, you know, you've caught that glimpse before where you're like, I think that buck had more stuff going on than a 4-point frame. So he goes into the trees. And you got to imagine that I'm sitting up on a hillside and I've got the public road right below me about, I don't know, half a mile. And then I'm looking about a mile out for that deer. And I got trucks and public guys going on four-wheelers, you know, looky-loos driving around. You got people, you know, yelling and kids in their four-wheelers. And it's crazy. That was my point. It's crazy that here I am hunting a big giant deer with all that activity. You'd think this buck was way up away from all this activity. Right. We finally put two and two together that he was living within this teeny tiny half-mile circle. And he was watering by that public road every night because there was a little creek that run there. And then he was just working his way up into the quake and aspen and sagebrush. There was this big sagebrush flat that started into our ranch. And one day, it was midday actually, I seen some tips of horns kind of flash. And it's right out in the middle of the sagebrush. You would never really be looking. You're looking in the trees. You're looking on the edge of the trees. Well, I catch a glimpse and I catch his frame do about a 180 degree turn and then disappear. So what he did, it was that you finally got this buck after 2 years, you figured out he just laid down. And what he did is he got up and he moved his bed and he laid back down midday. So now you got him, right? You know where he's laying. It gets pretty exciting at that time. So you come off that hill with your client and you get down there in that sagebrush and it's over your head. You figure out that, you know, you don't have no sight or anything. So the buck was real hard to pin down that way. He would lay down in that sagebrush all day long next to a public road. And this buck ended up being 218 that year. And you would just never guess where these bucks possibly live and their patterns to avoid any kind of pressure. But one day he got up a little bit early in the evening, and as luck would have it, a truck came down the road. And as soon as he heard the exhaust of this truck, and it was kind of a loud Dodge, if I can remember, if it had kind of a loud exhaust, I'll never forget, he kind of lifted his head up. We're watching him at about 700 yards. He lifted his head up, and he just kind of, you could see the wheels turn in his head for 10 seconds, and he laid down. Boom. Disappeared. Sagebrush. The truck just bumbles on by right below us. He goes on by, and 10 minutes later, it's almost dark. That buck gets up again and walks towards that creek, and he closes the distance to us, and we close the distance to him, and my client made a little less than 400-yard shot on him, and we got him.
Nice.
And I don't know. That was a real interesting thing for me to watch a buck's behavior when there's a lot of pressure like that. And we age these deer. You know, we pull those teeth, and we have the sentinum analysis done on them by a university. And that buck was 8 years old. And you got to remember that we'd seen him the year before in the headlights. So he had avoided the public and even us for a couple of years doing that little tactic that he was doing.
Yeah.
So that's one of my fonder stories of maybe outsmarting a buck that was real smart.
That's really cool. Like it's amazing how they learn these, you know, tactics, so to speak, you know, like we're learning hunting tactics. They're learning hunter evasion tactics. I've seen some pretty crazy things, and I've heard some pretty crazy stories doing this. Yeah. Trying to remember who it was. I think it was Jason Mattson who shared a story with me about a buck that they shot wounded that walked back on its own trail and stepped in the exact same like holes, you know, the same footprints in the snow. And just like stuff like that is just like, you don't give these animals enough credit, you know, where the intellects, right? You know, and you think they don't have, you know, that they operate mostly on instinct and you know, programming and whatnot. But every once in a while, you start looking at stuff like that and seeing patterns like this and how they, and you're like, man,
yeah,
these guys actually sit here and think about this a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems to be with older bucks. I mean, Coos Deer World, I'm sure, is the same. When you're dealing with, like I say, a mule deer that gets above 6 years old, or maybe a Coos Deer. I'm not as familiar with Coos Deer, but when they get to be older bucks, you've heard that argument, what's smarter, a mule deer or a whitetail? You know, I'll give it to you that a mule deer is not real smart when he's between 2 and 4 years old, that kind of buck. He's pretty vulnerable. He's not. But there's some kind of a switch there that when they get to be that real old age structure, man, they go into a whole different category of smart. Evade and survive is pretty incredible.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. As a whole, I find that whitetail tend to be a little bit more. I don't like to use the word smart. They're just more cunning, I guess, you know, or a little more sly.
Yeah,
and definitely more skittish, and that's I think that's why people think mule deer are dumb, is that they're just a bit braver. You know, they're not as quick to, you know, they'll give you the look where a whitetail, if it's running, it ain't gonna stop and turn and look back at you. you know,
the mule deer definitely has a reputation of giving you that last look.
Yeah, you know.
And they tend to hang in more open country too, so they're a little more visible.
Right.
So.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I've had this argument many times on social media and whatever. Like, matter of fact, I think I posted it on Facebook last year or something like that. And I said, "Who thinks what's harder to kill, a coos buck or a desert muley?" And like a bunch of guys arguing with me, you know. Both ways. Me personally, I think coos deer are a bit harder to kill with a bow, but I think they're easier to kill with a rifle, and mainly because it's easier to find a big coos buck with a rifle versus a big muley with the rifle.
Right.
During those seasons, during those time periods. But anyway, with a bow, I think it's a lot easier to stalk a mule deer than it is a coos buck, but there's a million people gonna tell me the opposite, so
well, there's always it's always a good conversation if everybody will just, you know,
leave it as a conversation.
you don't want it to get away from, you know, you're the absolute authority on this and I'm the absolute authority on that and we need to argue. I think it's really good is to have good, you know, good-hearted hunting community.
Yeah.
Talk about it. It's just a good conversation to have.
Open dialogue. Yep.
Yeah, but we're all animals that we're talking about. It's just a pleasure to go out and try and match wits with any of these animals. And granted, there's times when they're vulnerable, you know, in the rut and things like that. I sort of like to put a feather in the cap after you've kind of taken them on a non-vulnerable time. You know, they're not in the rut. They're not.
Yeah.
You know, I always like those times. It's very satisfactory, I guess.
I think for me, like those mid-season hunts are always the toughest.
They are.
You know, they've already, you don't have them on summer patterns anymore. You know, right. They strip their velvet so they can get in the deepest, darkest shit they want to.
And they don't.
They've already been shot at once or twice, you know. I mean, over here in Arizona, may not be cool enough. May not be, you know, it's still pretty warm, so they're not required to feed, put on as much feed, so they're not up and running around, you know. But yeah, those.
They lay like logs. They're lazy.
Yeah.
I think they don't have to come out. They're a little bit scared of the pressure. They right. don't have to put on any body fat. Their body fat's pretty well ready to go for, you got to think about it. They're essentially put, you know, here to breed.
Yeah.
They're not thinking about doing that. They don't have to get up and do anything except wait for that time period to kick in.
Oh yeah, so for sure.
They get nocturnal and lazy. And how many of those animals have you taken in November that still haven't even stripped all their velvet off? They're so lazy.
Yeah. Yep.
You know,
happens all the time.
Keeps them alive. Yeah. You know, I was listening to a couple of your, when you invited me on here, I wanted to listen to a couple of your last guests. Those guys are incredible. Those Colin guys.
Oh, you know, the elk guys. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been hunting elk all my life and guiding elk all my life. And I thought I would just tell you, I've never been a good caller. It's never been something I'm great at. And I don't understand all the nuances of the elk call. I obviously call and I bring them in and all that stuff. But I took my mule deer tactics early on in my career, and I've been successful in guiding a lot of big elk. I took my mule deer tactics, John, to hunting elk. And it might not be the funnest thing because I'm not the guy that's over there getting them to pipe off. And, you know, I don't get satellite bulls running me over because I'm calling and stuff. I'm the guy who's going to hunt them like a mule deer. I slip in, use the wind, you know, get above them when you need to, when the thermals, get below them when you need to with the thermals, or get right to the side of them. And I never make a peep. I've had a lot of success just slipping in on those herd bulls with their cows by not making one sound.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm with you. Like, don't get me wrong. I love to call and I love learning the whole language of elk and all that. I'm kind of geek out on it and it's kind of my thing. But I look back to when I first started elk hunting. Now, mind you, my first three elk were cows, but you know, my first three archery elk, I don't think I made a single call, you know, and I actually still hunted for them. You know, I took some East Coast tactics that I never, you know, never would, I wouldn't say never, but I wouldn't really use here now that I've adopted other ways, but yeah. You know, if I think about it, I'm like, I was successful. I didn't have a whole lot of experience. This was the late 90s.
Right.
Late 90s, early 2000 when I killed my first couple of elk.
Yeah.
And, I just still hunted. I just walked through the woods, you know, slow and quiet. And I wasn't in a unit where I can glass. So that was my other option, you know, and I didn't really know how to call. Yeah, I can make a cow call, but and I had the brand new Hoochie Mama that had just came out, and you know, yeah. I had some stuff, but I don't know.
It's crazy still to this day. And you know, granted, I'm not in the thick timber like some, you know, some places they have to call and they have to locate with their ear and their sound. I'm fortunate enough to hunt ground everywhere I'm at that's fairly open. I mean, these elk will timber up for the daytime and the early morning, you know, bed and stuff.
But there's open parks and stuff.
Yeah, I'll catch them in the parks and I'll catch them on the hillsides. And it's just a matter of getting in close enough to that herd bull. And if you get in close to him, and then you can cow call and do a little bugling to get him to come. But you got to be real close to him to get him to come away from them cows. Otherwise, he's just going to push them away.
Mm-hmm.
So I've taken that mule deer tactic right to elk hunting. And, you know, some of these guys that come hunting with me, they want to have the whole experience. And so we have to go mess with satellite bulls and get that experience. But I just kind of want to get in on that herd bull and get him killed.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't we all? I fell in love with the whole calling thing. So I think the fourth tag that I just had an amazing experience. It was here in Arizona. I had heard some cows kind of mewing down below me, and I was coming across this I don't even want to call it a ridge. It was a, just kind of like a slight hill slide. I was above them, but they were, it wasn't very steep. And I just started like walking and kind of like calf calling at the time. And out of nowhere, I just, you know, this bugle lets out and I see these antlers just start emerging from the, you know, from the trees below me. And I'm like, oh shit. But I didn't have a bull tag. I had a cow tag in my pocket. And I'm like, oh man, you know? And so I just, and like, I sat down by a tree and I gave one more call. I sat down by a tree and I was trying to get my camera out. You know, I didn't have a, you know, a cell phone camera at the time or anything like that. Right. Actually, I don't think smartphones were even out. I was trying to get, you know, pull my camera out of my backpack and I couldn't get out. And this guy, he was on me, man. He came right to the same tree that I was at. And I was just sitting there with my legs out in front of me. And he was like 2 yards from my feet, just standing there walking, just kind of looking. And then he got like, well, there's nothing here now. And he puts his head down. And he starts feeding. When I shit you not, his nose was probably 2 feet from my feet. And I always tell people, this is a testament to my scent control regime that I follow. And I used to be really, back then I was really, really, really like, man, I didn't wear the same set of clothes from the morning to the afternoon. Like I didn't like nothing. Just cause I came from a whitetail hunting world, you know? And even though I've been hunting out here out west since I moved out here in 1991, but you know, my roots were in whitetail and those guys are serious about
their scent.
Scent control. So, but man, like after I had that experience, I thought he was going to step on my legs, man. I was like, I was almost afraid at the same time as in awe, and I couldn't get any of it on film because he was on, I was afraid to move and whatever.
Yeah.
But it was such a cool experience. And after that, I was like, I got to learn how to freaking call. Cause that was cool as shit.
It is cool. Yeah. What'd that bull end up doing? Did he end up?
He ended up feeding off and it went back down to the cows that were below. And I actually end up slipping back in on that herd later on that, it was already evening, but you know, maybe like an hour or two later, like right before dark. And I shot a cow and, consequently I couldn't find it. We went back and I found the blood trail and I kept finding it. And I got to one last spot where there's a giant blood pot of, you know, pile of blood and then nothing, not a speck anywhere. The only thing I could think of is somebody found it and took it.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a pretty effed up situation. And,
was that in Arizona?
Yeah, it was in Arizona.
Hmm. Public lands, open tag, all that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not an open tag. You know, everybody has, you have to draw that tag. But so I don't know. I really don't know. Like at one point when we were looking, I had heard like a side-by-side or something, maybe. Right. You know, it's like when they first came out with those Rangers. Yeah. Or not the Ranger, what was the Yamaha?
Rhino.
Yep. I heard one below us and that eventually that's where we end up going down to where I found the last blood. And I had a deer taken, in New York a few years back, but I found the gut pile and everything, but this, I didn't see no gut pile or anything on this one. So I don't know.
You harvested the deer and someone got to it before you?
Yeah, I shot it and, the direction of where I hunt in Long Island, it's only like a 5-acre woodlot and there's some swamp land on either side of it. But if the deer run, east or west, they could run into somebody's backyard basically, you know? So, I thought it was a marginal shot when I made it and I didn't want to push it. So, I'm like, I'm just going to let it lay till tomorrow morning. There's no coyotes there. The biggest predator there is, you know, red fox. So I'm like, all right, I'll just let it lay. And I went the next morning, got on the blood trail right away, got to, hell, I should have went after it because where I found that, you know, the gut pile was, you know, maybe 75 yards further than, you know, I had stopped the night before. And I got there and it was a fucking gut pile and no deer. So, yeah.
Fortunately, I haven't had any of that kind of experience in my days. But
yeah,
that would be unnerving.
Yeah, it happens, man. I've seen just about everything in this world when it comes to, yeah. You know, I've been part of a lot of good stuff too. But you know, I've been part of some crazy things that you would never think.
Yep.
So
I had this elk hunt one time real quick, there again, we knew this bull was up there, and we're sort of in open country, and there's a big creek bottom down low. We're about 9,000 feet, and we're in mid-September. And this is the smartest rut bull I've ever been around. You know, when people think elk in the rut, they think they get super dumb, and they do. You know, that's definitely, they're vulnerable then. But this bull here, he was something else, and he had a characteristic that was extremely easy to see. Mm-hmm. It was a beam that turned up on one side and the other one turned down. So you can imagine whale tail on one side and a main beam that turns up, hooks up hard. So you could always see him. And we called him Offset. And it was crazy. This bull, he would be down with his cows. He was a big herd bull. We ended up taking him. He was a little over 400. But he would have his group of cows, 25 cows. And he would leave those cows. He would rut them at night. We figured out that he was rutting at night, and he was actually smart enough to leave those cows and go a half a mile into the trees and just stand in there. And every once in a while, he'd pipe off and let a bugle out, but he'd never show himself. You would just catch him going in with that crazy offset right at light, or you'd catch him sneaking out right when the sun was going down. Anyway, we were rifle hunting. Mm-hmm. We pulled a John Stallone archery, and we went in with our moccasins on, and we went real slow. We ended up smoking him at like 25 yards in his bed. And it was crazy because that bull laid his head down on a log, kind of, I don't know if it was on the log. I could just see his tines, and we were working in there, take a step, archery style, right?
Yeah.
We never moved a peep. Anyway, that bull had his head, his chin on the ground. And I was actually with a woman hunter, and she ended up shooting that bull kind of facing on to us. I said, put it on the bottom of his chin when he lifts his head up. Anyway, that was the smartest rut bull I've ever been around. So when you think they're all sort of dumb that time of year, this was just a real smart bull. He evaded us for about the entire month of September.
That's crazy. Like, it's so counter, I don't know if the word is counterintuitive, maybe, of like what you would think.
That's what,
what you would think, that time of year, you know, they're so protected. They don't want to lose any, you know, but he was just letting the scows out there to, you know, who knows? I know, sat on the board, came in and scooped them out, you know, cut a hot cow out of the herd, whatever.
Yeah, it was crazy. He was smart enough to evade, because we were pressuring him. He knew we were there. He'd see our truck, or he'd feel our presence, I think.
Yeah.
He was smart enough to evade death. Like, he was with it enough to evade it and not have that instinct to breed, overtake him. That's why I brought the story up. Out of all the elk I've ever hunted, he comes into mind quick when it comes to being a keen. Not all bulls get completely dumb. And I haven't necessarily had that happen with any bull but him over the thousands of bulls I've been around. So I thought that was an interesting story to bring up, because most people like you, it's counter to what we all know.
Yeah.
Mid-September. But we finally got him. And all I could think was he would go out at night and round them all back up and try and breed them, whichever ones that were ready. And then he would leave them. And he was a big, big, big bull, just a real big bull. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Those are the stories. Those are the things, though, you learn, you know. I think that's why I like doing these storytelling type sessions. And, like, there's these, like, little tidbits of information that, you know, you're probably not going to see something like that. But, you know, you might be able to call back on this story and say, oh, yeah, man, there was this. Maybe I should check over here. You know, because, like, when I was doing these, you know, what would you do type elk podcast recently, one of my scenarios, like, you know, you could hear cows down below you, but you're not sure there's a bull there or whatever. Like, how many times have you come across in September where you find a group of cows and there's no bull right there with them, but you know that there's a bull hanging out in the outskirts somewhere right there, kind of just waiting for one of them to come in? Or just like, now you saying this makes me think, maybe they just might be one of these smart bulls that doesn't want to show his face until, you know.
Yeah. I know there's bulls like
so.
I know there's bulls like that. That,
yeah.
Think about this, John. You're out elk hunting, and like you say, you come across a group of cows, and you got four or five satellite bulls, and you got a 350 bull rutting the herd. And just in the side of your mind and in your hearing, you can hear a bull up in the trees or down over here. A mile or to your right, a half a mile, but you're really not paying attention to that particular bugle. It sounds good, but you're really not paying attention to it because you got all the eye candy right here in front of you. Yep. And that 350 bull looks pretty dang good and, you know, and carrying on, and they're doing their thing and it's fun to watch. But how many times have you heard that lone bugle up in the edge of the trees? That is that bull I just told you the story about. Not all, and I'm not saying that's that bull, but it could be. That's why I mentioned it.
Right.
It made me think different when I got out the rest of the years after that. I'm really open-minded about what I'm hearing and seeing. And not everything meets the eye that you're seeing. You need to kind of fall off experience and kind of think, well, you know, that bugle's interesting right over here. I know this is really fun to watch, but I got to figure out what that is a half a mile to my right. Before we go and hammer this bull down here with the herd, we might have something a little better up in the trees. Yeah. And it doesn't always work that way, but you're right. Someone listening, they're going to get on the ridge this September and they're going to remember that. And maybe it helps. Maybe it doesn't turn out. Most times it don't. But that one time for us, it was the difference between settling for a 350 or 60 class bull and hammering a bull of a lifetime. So I thought that was a neat thing that happened to me in my career.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, awesome, man. I enjoyed the stories and I want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us. Where can our listeners find out more about you?
Well, we got a website, bucksandbulls.com. So spell out the and. bucksandbulls.com. You can also find me on Instagram. That's the only social media that I mess around with, and that's Bucks and Bulls Outfitter. And give us a call. I mean, we're an old-fashioned outfitting company, so we love to talk on the phone. And 801-785-5050. Love to awesome. Talk to anybody that wants to just chit-chat. Well, and thanks, I appreciate man. You letting me on here, John. It's been
fun. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'll come on anytime.
No, we love having you. Like I said, I like getting different perspectives. You know, most of the guys that I have on are public land hunters, and most of my viewership is, or listenership, or whatever you want to call it, is, you know, public land hunters. But I think there's something to be, you know, there's something to be learned from everybody, and everybody's sure. got something to offer. So like, I just, and I say that because I think sometimes, and I'm sure it'll happen on this podcast, if people listen to you in the beginning, be like, oh, this is not going to fit the bill for me because right. I don't have access to private land. So,
but their tactics, the tactics that you use are, you know, looking right. into the sun, like we talked about. The other thing that they need to always, other than a massive weather change or something, those mule deer and coos deer, I believe, don't ever give up hope that they are right there. If you know you've seen the buck of your dreams within a particular spot, He is there. He did not go somewhere. And you know, I'm not, unless there's a big snowstorm or something like that, or
I'm with you. You know, or
you need to have faith. And I know it's hard. You gotta. I'm talking day 7, day 8, day 9, day 10. You need to still be hunting in that, basically that jail cell. You need to go put yourself in that every day, and mentally tell yourself and have faith that that dream animal that you caught a glimpse of 8 days ago is still right there within a half mile. Don't ever give up on that. That is definitely made it to where we've had a lot of success by having that faith.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Thanks for coming on, and we'll stay in touch for sure. Maybe we'll get you back on again.
Yeah, be my pleasure. Thank you, John.